Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 215, I chat with the inimitable audiophile extraordinaire Michael Fremmer about high-res audio and vinyl LPs. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded July 17th, 2014, episode 215, High-Res Vinyl. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and editor of AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is the inimitable audiophile, the audiophile's audiophile, Michael Fremmer, editor of AnalogPlanet.com, and a longtime friend of mine and a champion of vinyl LPs and analog electronics. Hey, Michael, welcome back to the show.
Yes, I am. Thank you very much. It's great to be with you again. Make sure this is working here. Wait. Okay.
Yes, working perfectly.
Yeah, it is.
Actually, I figured out this is your fifth appearance on Home Theater Geek, so it makes you one of the most often returned guests, and I'm glad to say, because you're always very interesting to talk to.
Well, maybe I'll break the precedent this time.
I hope not. Hey, those who are tuned in live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Michael as we go along, and I will pass along as many as I can. So, Michael, you recently, or maybe not so recently, took a trip and visited Abbey Road Studio.
And, yes, I did.
Couldn't talk about it for a while.
No,
but now finally you can. So, what was it like being there where so much musical history was made?
Well, I had to hold it in for a year and a couple of months. So, you know, it was like being on the highway and there's no rest area, but it was for over a year. That's what it felt like. They wouldn't let me until they had the official announcement that that they were going to release the mono box set. So I had the story all written. And so what happened was I reviewed the stereo box set and I didn't really like what they did. But I was respectful, and I try to be respectful for the most part, even when I'm very critical, because it's very easy. The only place I'm not respectful is when I'm on the comment boards on Yahoo and people say idiotic political things. Then I'm anonymous anyway, so I go crazy. But you know, I wrote what I thought was wrong with what they did conceptually, which was that they chained, you know, first of all, they cut the vinyl from like 24-bit. 44K digital files. And the digital files that they produced had been, they changed, they did certain things to them. They did a little bit of compression. They did some whatever EQ they thought was best. They didn't maintain what the original tapes were like, and they didn't maintain what the original record sounded like. And so some of them came out pretty good, but some of them were like Abbey Road was just, I think, terrible. At any rate, I wrote what I thought was very, and they contacted me all of a sudden 2 years ago in May and said, we read what you wrote, read your criticism, and everybody here has decided that when we do the mono box, which we really think is the more important box, then we're going to do it kind of like the way you envisioned that the stereo box should have been done. So, of course, first of all, I was totally flattered that.
No kidding. Yeah,
and we'd like you to come over and see what we're doing, and so it was like, wow, really? I would love that. And the timing of the dates they proposed were actually right after the Munich show in 2013.
So you were in Europe anyway.
Yeah. So I went from Munich to Abbey Road, and I met my friend Steve Berkowitz. So this is a great story because Steve Berkowitz. You may know his name. He produces all the Miles Davis reissues and the Bob Dylan boxes, the anthology boxes. And he used to be a Sony Legacy employee, but now he's a freelancer. And he's in charge, basically, of all of that. And so the amazing thing is that in 1969, when I went to law school, and dropped out. one of the first days I was there, I was at BU Law School, and I walked to Kenmore Square just to see what was going on down the block, and there was a record store, and it was on a corner, so it must have been a former pharmacy or something, because you'd walk up, have to walk up these stairs and go into the record store, and at the top of the stairs was a point of purchase cardboard thing with a bunch of records in it, and I couldn't see what the records were, but I knew at that point that imported records were not shrink-wrapped tight like we did it, because they realized overseas that you could warp the records. So they were in these loose-fitting poly bags. So I knew whatever record this was, it was an import. And I walked up the steps, and it was Abbey Road, and you know, the imported version. So I immediately bought a copy. I wish I had bought 10, but I only bought one. And I later found – I ended up doing the radio commercials for that record store for about 8 years after that. And what I learned was that the person who actually was responsible for putting those records on in the store was this guy, Steve Berkowitz. Mm. And now Steve was inviting me all these 40-something years later to visit Abbey Road. It was because of him that I was invited, essentially.
That's very cool.
That was very cool. So I flew from Munich and went to London and had dinner with him that night with Eric Clapton's touring drummer, who my brain fade is making me forget who it is. You can probably look it up and get his name. Mm-hmm. I just forgot it. Really nice guy. We had a great time. And then Tuesday, I spent the whole day at Abbey Road, and they said to me, well, you can't see the studio too, where everything was recorded, because a session is booked and we can't turn it into a tourist trap. I said, okay, look, this is fine. Whatever you're going to show me is going to be, you know, more than I ever expected I'd be getting to see. So when I got there, they said, you know, the band is late, so you can go in. So they took me downstairs, and first, of course, before I walked in, I walked across the street. I did the whole thing. I didn't take my shoes off. I didn't go barefoot because it was very cold out and raining. But then I went inside, and then they said, okay, you can walk in studio too. So they opened the door, and I walk in. And first of all, it's an old place, you know, and it's built over a swamp, and it's really musty smelling. And I started walking in, and then, you know, after I was in a couple of steps, then I could start seeing what I had only seen in pictures, and, you know, with the Beatles and everything. And it was just, it was overwhelming. It was really, I was totally taken by surprise by my reaction. I couldn't walk in. It was like, you know, you have a dream sometimes, like you're walking someplace and you just can't walk there.
Sure.
That's what happened. So I got about far enough in so I could turn around and see the steps going up to the control booth. I'm sure everybody's seen those pictures. And then I did not want to walk in further because I didn't want to spoil the distance. It's very strange.
It almost sounds like a religious experience.
It was like a religious experience. It was one I wasn't expecting. I was expecting to just walk in the studio. I've been in a lot of studios, you know, so I just thought I'd walk in and that would be that, but I couldn't. I just could not. I got far enough in to say I was in Studio 2, and I looked around, and, you know, and that was that. Wow. It's like the time I interviewed George Martin in New York when he put out that very strange record where he had, like, Jim Carrey singing I Am the Walrus. Do you remember that record?
Yeah, I do remember that.
Yeah. And so I interviewed him, and so I walked in the hotel room, and there was George Martin, and I just kept expecting that, you know, the Beatles would be in the other room, you know, but I couldn't see them. It was really weird, but they weren't there. I got all these great places, but late, a little late. But anyway,
little late.
So then I got to hear I heard the White Album playback, and I heard them cut the lacquers for the White Album. So I got to hear the master tape of the White Album, all four sides.
So that was the final master mix of the White Album. Was it mono?
It was mono, yeah. So they put the mono tape up, and they had all of the mastering notes. Well, the way they did it was the tapes were actually in very good shape because the mono tapes weren't used. The stereo tapes were in good shape too, actually. But they did a 96K 24-bit transfer of the whole catalog, and then they listened to what it sounded like, and then they got original UK pressings. And they got an Ornophon 2M Black with the Shibata stylus, and they compared
the turntable.
Yeah, they compared the records, the 1A press, you know, the first pressings, which in parlophone, an EMI language, would be a dash one lacquer, a first mother, and a G on the right side, which is part of their matrix code. And they compared those to the tape. And then they had the original mono mastering notes from Harry Moss. And they didn't have – it's not the same board. It's not all tubes like it was. But they got as close as they could to the original EQ, which was not that – there wasn't that much EQ applied to it. And, of course, the speakers are different. Everything's different. And they did their best to get it to sound as close to the original as possible.
So. And the original reference in this case was the master tape or one of the original vinyl pressings?
The vinyl pressing was the reference that Steve Berkowitz always shoots for the 1A pressing to be the reference, because that's, the tape is really not the Holy Grail. The tape is the raw material from which the Holy Grail is created. Mm. Like when Chad Kasem first started reissuing records, he got some of the contemporary catalog. So he released Way Out West, the Sonny Rollins album, which is a very famous record. And, mm-hmm. Put the tape up and cut it flat and blah, blah, blah. Well, it turns out that Roy Dunan, who was the engineer, when he made those records, when he made those tapes, he purposefully boosted the top end pretty far up to get above the noise floor so that when he mastered it to vinyl, which was the thing, he would lower the top end and it would literally take down the noise, take down the hiss, just kind of like a primitive Dolby system.
I was going to say, that sounds a lot like what Dolby's doing, but he did it manually.
That's right, because Dolby hadn't been invented in 1957 or whatever.
Right, exactly.
But the bottom line is you can't say that the master tape is the Holy Grail, because you don't know what the person who made the tape, what his final goal was with it. It's basically the raw material from which the final product is made.
Mm. So they used the vinyl, a particular, the first pressing, the 1A pressing, as you call it.
Right.
As the reference, and they wanted to get as close to that as possible. So they took the mono master tape, digitized it at $24.96.
Right. Just to listen. Just to do the listening.
And
then when they did the cutting, it was cut from the tape, not from any digital. It was a pure analog cut.
But if they had to do any kind of manipulation, as you said, the master tape is not the reference, it's the raw material. So they had to tweak it in one way or another before it actually got to vinyl.
Well, they had to do the EQ moves to it, and they got the EQ set. Once the EQ was set for the albums, they didn't have to touch it. The only place where it got tricky was they did there's a 3-album compilation of the past masters, the singles and unreleased things. And those were spliced together. Again, everything was done in the analog domain, everything, including the compilations. So they spliced it all together. And then they had to worry about azimuth, because all
which
of those.
Which is
the angle of the tape head against the tape.
Mm.
And since all of those tracks were recorded at different times, the singles, the azimuth was different, so they had to have notes. And as the lacquer was being cut, Sean McGee, the mastering engineer, would sit there with a screwdriver on the tape head, and he had little marks made for where each track had to be. And between tracks, he would turn it and
change the azimuth. Wow,
exactly. So it was definitely purist. It was done exactly the way I would hope that they would have done the stereo box. So now my dream is that, after all the stereo boxes are sold, that somebody could license some of the stereo titles and do it the same way from tape.
Mm-hmm.
So
tell me again how it was that they did the stereo box that was not ideal.
So the stereo box, so first they did a 192 24-bit transfer of everything, just flat transfer.
Of all the analog tapes, they just scanned them or digitized them at 24 bits, 192 kilohertz.
Right. And then they fixed things up, like if they were popped peas, like I'm doing all over the place here, or little noises in the studio or whatever things they wanted to fix, they would fix them. And I think what's on that tape, what came, what was released originally, that's what should be left. That's what, that's the holy grail to me. Not
the purest,
not
the purest approach for sure.
Yeah. And they also, and then once they'd finished, they decimated it down to 44K, 24 bit. And they did the CDs. And of course,
well, the CD CDs would have to be 44.116.
16. And the little USB stick. You've seen the USB stick?
No.
I could go get it. But
nah, don't worry about it. Don't
it's a really cool thing. It's an Apple, and it's got the entire catalog on this beautiful little heavy metal green Apple. And you pull up the core, you pull up the little stem, and there's the USB, and that is 24-bit 44.1. And okay, that sounds so substantially better than the CDs because its bit rate is better. And so
the bit depth is better.
Yeah, depth, not rate. Depth. I'm sorry, I misspoke.
Right.
And so the records are really very similar to the Apple USB stick, but they claim with a little bit less compression. But you know, when Jeff Emmerich, who recorded Abbey Road, heard it, he was outraged because he said when they recorded songs like Because, all of the blend of the voices was done live with all the guys standing around a microphone and at different distances to get the voices to blend. Mm-hmm. And it's if you hear an original pressing of Abbey Road, it's magic. But instead of letting that breathing take place, they just added compression. They compressed it, so all the voices are squashed together. Why did they
criminal
do that?
Criminal, I tell you.
And then on top of that, Rubber Soul and Help are from a remix that George Martin did in the 80s at 1644. So the only place you can get the higher resolution version is the original mix, which is actually on the mono box, the mono CD box. Did you know that?
No.
It's crazy. The mono CD box. So
there's a mono CD box and also a vinyl?
There's a mono CD box, a stereo CD box, a stereo vinyl box, and now there's going to be a mono vinyl box.
Okay, but the mono CD box has been out for a while?
Yeah, a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
But again, it was 24-bit, a CD quality, you know.
Well, yeah. Well, this brings up one of the main things I wanted to actually talk to you about today, which is going back to the original analog tapes, which these obviously were, and there are a lot of master tapes done in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s that are analog. And then digitizing that at high res at 2496, 24192, or whatever. And my question for you is, how much information is there on those analog tapes that goes out that far? I mean, do you really need 24 bits to capture the dynamic range on an analog tape?
Well, you know, there are two ways of looking at all of this. You can use measurements to determine what you hear, which some people, you know, they do. They get led around by the measurements. Well, I just get led around by my ear. You know, I trust my ear more than I trust measurements. There's information on records well above 50K. And
this is vinyl LPs you're talking about here.
Yes. Yes. And even after you play them, you know, 100 times, it's still there. I don't care what anybody says. You can. That's been measured. I've seen spectrum analyses of this. When they in the 70s, they had quadraphonic sound. Remember quadraphonic sound?
Oh, I remember it well.
Yeah. So quadraphonic sound relied upon a pilot tone, a 50K or even higher pilot tone engraved in the vinyl that I don't know exactly how the process worked, but the pilot tone was on there at 50K, and that was on a record. So it's proof that you can get 50K on a record. I saw a spectrum analysis of a direct-to-disc record that was response was like 60K, up to 60K. And you see this wonderful spectrum all the way up in there. And then you see the CD version. And it's like it's a haircut. You know, it's cut. it's not natural. We don't hear that way. We don't listen. That's not natural. And people who say, well, we can't hear above 20K. And of course, you get to my age, you don't hear above like 3K. Oh, I'm just kidding. But I saw research that I think is going to be made public at some point soon that was done in Japan, that they had sensors on people's brains, and they played them CDs, and there was a certain amount of brain activity. Then they played the same material at 192.24 a bit, and the brains lit up.
I mean, much more than the CD material.
Yeah, much more. Then they just played the above 20K stuff without the music part of it,
right,
without the, you know, the main, and there was no activity. But put the two together, and there was much more activity. And
wow, that's fascinating. So
it is
playing the ultrasonics essentially by themselves does nothing. It's the,
right,
it's the interaction or the combination. So according to this study, of the what you can hear and the ultrasonics, which somehow combine to produce more brain activity than if you only limit it to what you can, quote, theoretically hear in by the auditory system.
And the theory behind this, the theory so far that I've seen, is that all of the interaural timing cues that we rely upon, like to survive, you know, like when the tiger would break the tree thing behind you and you'd know where it is, that
right,
happens at very, very fast. That distance is very short, and those, that's very high speed, high frequency changes. Now, I'm not a scientist, but since I've spoken to scientists who tell me that CDs just sound much better than records, I know that science isn't really useful for everything, because it's just not true. Even if it's an additive thing, I don't care if it's not accurate. You know, it's an additive thing. I don't care, because everybody who's out there who knows video knows that a video mastering suite contains a monitor that's been calibrated.
Yep.
The color temperature is 6,500 degrees Kelvin. The color points are all mapped out. So everybody's mastering from the same, you know, looking at the same monitor. But
yep,
audio is not like that. Audio is whatever Schmendrick has in his studio, and he's going to mix it and master it to his taste. So so no matter what you do, unless you have his speakers, you're not going to have an accurate rendering of that piece of music. So if I can stick the music into this vinyl format, and it does something that makes it sound more like live music and more real and more pleasurable to me, whatever it's doing, that's all that's important to me. I'm not into this for the accuracy to I don't know what. Now, I don't want
Yeah, you've got me thinking about how an audio system could be made analogous to the video system, whereby, as you say, you've got very well-defined calibration parameters. You can get that video display to look like many other video displays if they're similarly calibrated. But can you do that with an audio system?
No,
I guess you could.
How?
I guess you could, in terms of, well, by measuring the frequency response, but of course that's in a room. And so when you listen to it, you'll be in a different room, so that'll be different.
You'd need the curve of every speaker that's used in mastering every record, CD. And then you would put that algorithm into your system to duplicate the frequency response, but you wouldn't have the phase response, you wouldn't have the off-axis response. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But when digital recording first happened, what was the first thing that recording studios did after they heard what it sounded like? In case you don't remember, they went out and bought two microphones to soften it up. And the next thing they did was buy Pultec equalizers and compressors, because the sound they were getting, you know, because microphones are all terrible. There are no good microphones. They're all terrible. So,
well, I'm not sure I agree with that.
They're not terrible, but they're not linear.
I'll agree with.
Yeah. And the concept of stuffing a symphony orchestra down a couple of microphones is absurd, you know. So again, I don't like speakers that are grossly nonlinear. I'm not talking about that. But, you know, I sat in a mastering suite and I heard a Nat King Cole master tape compared to a lacquer that had just been cut of that master tape. And we switched it back and forth. And you'd be hard-pressed to hear a difference. Now, by the time it gets plated and pressed and you're playing it at home, you know, it's not going to be quite the same. But the differences between a cut record and a tape are way overstated by the people who think, you know, vinyl is this horribly colored medium. And, you know, at this point in time, I don't even have to get into this discussion because I won. Ha, ha, ha. Vinyl's back. That's all I care about. Everybody can get what they want today. You know, you want to listen to...
Well, that's true.
You know, you want all-you-can-eat audio. That's my favorite buzzword. All-you-can-eat audio. That's what you get when you stream it. Have you ever gone to an all-you-can-eat restaurant? You know?
Unfortunately.
The outcome's not very good because usually what happens is you have diarrhea. That's what ends up happening. After you've eaten, you know, an entire buffet of fried food that was done on a fryolator that has, you know, the oil hasn't been changed in 6 months, you get sick.
Yeah.
And all-you-can-eat music, you know, I like meals. I like to sit down to a good meal. And then when I'm finished eating, I'm done. I don't graze all day. The idea of being able to sit there and stream music all day, it's a sickening thought to me.
Well, and it also gets to the point of what are you using the music for? You and I have talked about offline, you know, people don't sit down and listen to music. They put on music to do their dishes or vacuum the floor or whatever. It's in the background and you're not really paying attention.
It's a parasitic activity. It used to be an activity where, and it's not, you know, I hear people say, well, because records would only last 15 minutes, you have to get up and turn it over and blah, that's why you'd sit and listen to it. No, you'd sit and listen to it because it made you go, wow, and then you get into that zone. Because I still get into that zone when I put a record on. I don't do it from a CD. I just don't. And most people don't. When you talk to people and you say to them, I play records. Like, oh, I used to have records. I had 10,000 records. I got rid of my records. It's all CDs now. And I say, well, do you sit down like you used to sit down and listen to records? And they go, no, who's got time for that? I don't have time. I play it while I'm doing other things. Thank you. That proves my point. I don't know people who can actually sit there, turn a light out, and listen to us. Maybe some people can, but I can't. Yeah. And what's really sad about it is that music used to be, you'd pay attention to the artist. You'd pay attention to the producer, the engineer, what they were what is in that music, you know, and what the artist is saying, everything about what you hear. And it's become a parasitic activity where the energy of the musician and the beat and everything, it gets you in the vibe, in the mood, and then you do other stuff. You take that person's energy and you don't pay attention to them fully. And you do other stuff. It's like what conversations have become, you know, with phones. Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So I was, how you doing? Wait a second. That's what it's getting down to. And that's why when I talk to young people who I talk to a lot more, you know, I talk to a lot of kids and they tell me that they got a turntable and they put the record on and they sit there and they listen and there's something about it. Even if it's a digital source, there's something about whatever it's doing that they say, I like to sit and just put the record on and sit there and relax and listen to it and, you know, look at the liner notes and also it's limiting me to 12 songs that my favorite artist has put out for my enjoyment in a certain order that they want me to hear it in. And there's a connection that they get to the artist. Otherwise, they get just sort of all you can eat. You know, there's no form
to it. Once again,
not natural. Now, I think streaming is a great thing, like an Evertone sheet. Remember Evertone sheets?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, well,
they were in magazines, right?
Right. It would perforation. You pull it out and you play it.
And it would be like a little record, a little flexible vinyl record that you put on your turntable and it would play.
Right. Mad Magazine used to have those. They had songs. She Had a Nose Job was one of the first ones. And
speaking of nose jobs, which we were just before the show started.
And it's a gas. Was one about gas. And you'd play those. So I think I look at streaming music as an Evertone sheet where you hear something you might like, you know, on the stream and then say, oh, now I'm going to get it so I can hear what it actually sounds like. It's good for finding out about music. I've got Pandora and some of these other Rhapsody. I've got these things. And I use them for that. And I have Sirius Radio, so I listen to that. And it's so degraded. The sound of the music is so degraded that when a kid hears a good stereo, it's like, wow. You know, they get it immediately.
Yeah, yeah. Morris in the chat room is saying, the problem is that artists aren't making music for albums anymore.
Well, some are and some aren't. You know, I mean, you'd be surprised who is. You know, a lot of young artists are. It's mostly alternative rock. In the mainstream pop music, no, because those recordings are meant to be singles. And, you know, one of the problems with the album era was there were artists that weren't really album artists, but they were forced to put out an album. And so there'd be two good songs and a lot of junk. Mm-hmm. And then when CDs came out, remember, the record business killed the single, if you remember. They wouldn't release a CD single for a dollar. They had these CD, I don't know what they called them, but they had like four songs on it. The one song you wanted and three songs you hated.
Right.
And that's what killed the single. And so, you know, singles on iTunes, it's a great way to have this. Because I bought singles when I was a kid, and I still download singles from iTunes of things that I don't really want albums of. It's great. But I think a lot of artists, you know, you listen to like Beck or Ray LaMontagne or the Black Keys, all these guys, they're album artists, and they make albums that are coherent, and you listen to it from beginning to end, and it's a pleasurable thing. So this is a great period of time. This is the best period of time. If you think that, you know, 16-bit digital is perfect, then fine. But you can download the 9624 file of the same piece and listen and then decide either – doesn't make a difference. I'm right and fine. Or you can download it and listen and go, boy, I hear more. It's more space. I hear a finer, the transient response is smoother. It's just more pleasurable to my ear, whatever, for whatever reason. If you think so, fine. If you don't, you know, to me, the people say, well, the math shows me that 24-bit, 96-28, we've already reached the point where the dynamic range is wider and the frequency response is beyond what the human ear can hear. Fine, but why don't you listen to it and see what it sounds like?
Right. As a matter of fact, you're bringing up a point that I wanted to make sure that I mentioned here, which is this is exactly a sort of an experiment that I'm conducting on AVS Forum right now, which is I, with the help of Mark Waldrop, who's the founder and chief engineer of AIX Records, who records everything in 2496.
No, he doesn't.
Well, except for this one example that you showed me, and I haven't had a chance to talk to him about that yet, which we'll talk about. We'll mention that. But for the most part,
I should go get it while you're talking, because otherwise,
why don't you go get it while I'm talking? Okay, that's fine. Okay. So I'm going to tell the story here of the test on AVS, which is Mark Waldrop provided three tracks, complete full tracks of his music that he has recorded, not him playing, but his recordings. And they all contain information beyond 20 kilohertz in terms of frequency. And they have a dynamic range greater than 90 dB, which is typically no more than you get on a CD. So we've got these three tracks. They're in native 2496. We also, then what we did was we took those three tracks, copies of them, down converted them to CD specs, which is 16 bits, 44.1 kilohertz. Using a very, very high-end sample rate converter, and then reconverted them back up to 2496 so that they would have the same file size and the same, basically the same sort of specs. It would be difficult to tell them apart. And we level matched them, and I randomly assigned one of the two versions, the label A and the other one, the label B. And I randomly, one of them is the high res version and one of them is the down resed version. They're up on the website, and you can go download these files and listen to them and see if you can hear a difference. And you can send me the results. You know, you can say, send me a note on AVS Forum that says, I think that this track, the A version is high res, and in this track, the B version is the high res, and so on and so forth. And, you know, I'm going to collect data and just see what people think. Now, it's not a scientific experiment because we don't have enough control, because I don't know what system you're listening on, and I don't know whether or not you've cheated and gone in and looked at the spectrum of these files, because if you do that, you'll be able to tell which is which easily.
Right.
I don't, you know, hopefully I'm counting on, you know, the sense of fairness and, interest in scientific inquiry for people to just play these files and tell me which one they think is the high res.
Well, and I think science has its place in all of this, but science can be abused in all of this also. It can be overdone. I mean, I hear people say, well, you see, if I let you hear cables and then you know what the cables are and then you switch to another cable, it's really you're confused. You really don't know what's going on. The way to really do it scientifically is to have both cables attached to an ABX box, and then you go bah, 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 for half an hour or 40 minutes, and then tell me which is which. And if you can't, then that's scientific. That won't make you confused and ready to jump out of your skin and commit suicide going bah, 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 you know.
Well, it's
sitting,
sure
sitting and actually listening. Oh, because you can't, your brain, you know, you can be easily confused. You know, luckily, when the tiger was chasing you and you heard the stick, it wasn't a double-blind tiger test, because you really wouldn't survive that. You know, we survived pretty well with using our senses. Yes, you have to guard against being confused, but you know, I did a cable test on my website, and what happened was I was recording some tunes from vinyl to bring to the CES, and I played a Peter, Paul, and Mary cut that had a certain sound as I knew it, and it sounded brighter than I was used to hearing it. And then I realized I had changed the cable going from my tone arm to my phono preamp, and I put back the other cable, and it sounded like I expected it to sound. So I decided to see whether the readers could hear this. So I made it as a CD and brought it to CES, and I said, here are two tracks, St. Peter, Paul, and Mary song. Are these the same tracks, or is there something different? And virtually everybody in every room that I played those two that CD for said, they're different, and the second one's brighter. And that was exactly what it was. So I posted these files on the website, and I said, is this the same file or is it a different file? If it's different, what's the difference and which do you like better? And that's scientific. I don't care about that. I just care about seeing what people think. It's more interesting. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, everybody, well, I guess a majority, maybe 75 to 80% said the files are different and one sounds brighter than the other. Now, which they preferred was a matter of opinion. Some people liked the brighter one. They thought it had more life. And some people liked the other one that was kind of smoother. But they heard the difference. So then some professor in Austin, Texas, somehow saw the URL and he downloaded it. And he posted this really snide story on his website that either he forwarded to me or somebody said, those audio files, you know how those audio files are. Well, they claimed they heard this cable difference. So I downloaded the files and I put them on Audacity and I noted a 0.01% speed difference between the two files, 0.01%. And that is what accounted. Now, what I did was I made the timing exactly the same, and the files are posted on my website, and I don't think anybody can hear the difference. So a lot of my readers went over there and they said, no, we heard the difference. It's A is this one, B is that one. They got it right again, you know, and that shut them up.
Well,
and, you know, again,
anyway.
And then the cable skeptics go, well, you know, certainly the capacitance, the resistance is probably different, and so big deal. Well, guess what? Every cable that's manufactured is, you know, balances capacitance, resistance, inductance. All of these factors get balanced in the final thing that they produce. And the conductors are different, the material. Now, of course, there are people who say there's no difference between silver and gold. And fine, I hear a difference. So I don't care what they think. And that's all I care about. They hear a difference. So it's interesting, though, because the poo-pooers are just, they're very active.
Well, so are the audiophiles, though. In one discussion thread about this test that I put on AVS, and by the way, in the chat room, I put the link to it, and it's still on the homepage. So you just go to avsforum.com, scroll down a ways to the AVS AIX High Res Audio Test Take 2. I had to do it second version.
I downloaded it.
Oh, you haven't heard it yet? Okay, I absolutely want to hear your response to this test. Play those six tracks labeled A2 and B2 because this is take two. I had to redo it. But Play those two tracks and tell me which one you think is high res. I'm sure, I'm virtually certain anyway. I'll be very surprised, let's put it that way, if you can't tell the difference, because you know, you're able to, and you probably have a good system that can really reproduce the whole spectrum that we're talking about, which is another factor that I wanted to talk to you about, which is, you know, the system that you have to play back on. Most consumer systems cannot reproduce ultrasonics or the dynamic range beyond 80 or 90 dB.
Right.
So what is the advantage of high-res audio there? I was going to ask you, in fact, about that brain scan test you told us about earlier. I hadn't asked, do you know what kind of system they were using? Was it actually able to reproduce the ultrasonics?
I don't know what the system was. I haven't gotten the details of that yet. But, you know, again, you're going on the basis of frequency response and dynamics. And I think there's more – I think measurements, what we measure – doesn't give us everything that's going on. It's a much more complicated thing. It's like when you look at measurements of loudspeakers, which, you know, Stereophile publishes measurements of loudspeakers, which I think is a really good thing.
I agree.
But measurements don't tell you everything, because the brain, after looking at the measurements, has to try to take all of those things and jiggle them and figure out what it all ends up sounding like. And so many people end up looking at the on-axis frequency response and distortion, and then that's all. They don't look at the off-axis response. They don't look at the transient response. They don't look at the phase response, and they don't have an ability, because you can't, of putting all those factors together and coming up with what the sound is actually like. All those things have to be factored together. And just there's something going on. We don't know everything yet. You know, we don't know.
I would agree with that.
Our brains are so much more sensitive, I believe, than anything we can measure. I got into a discussion when third octave equalizers were invented. Third octave equalizers. And then what would happen is they would take those third octave equalizers and they would flatten the response and go, say, now we have flat response. And I remember getting into arguments with certain people. I'm not even going to mention names because they're known people. And I said, this just doesn't sound right. It sounds anemic. It sounds like you've cut the bass is cut off. It's just I don't like this. I don't want to listen. Well, because you're not used to flat frequency response. You like this colored response and blah blah blah. So I don't want to listen to this. I don't care what it is. Well, once they were able to divide up the bandwidth into much more fine little chops.
Sure. 12th octave equalizers, for example.
Yeah, they discovered that when you flatten the third octave thing, you were getting rid of things that you didn't want to get rid of. You were not really flattening the response. You were putting dips in it that you didn't want to dip. And so the better the equalizers got, the more it became useful. And of course, the phase response was being chopped up too. Phase response was being destroyed also, but that's a whole nother issue.
That's a whole nother story.
Yes.
Andy, so in Germany's I'm sorry, go ahead.
I just want to say that I participated in many double blind tests. I did a double I guess it was an I don't know if it's a double blind test, but it was out at Harman. They have the speaker testing room that's really interesting. Done in mono, and they play you this music and you can't see what you're listening to. The speakers are behind a screen, and when they change speakers, each speaker that was being played would come out and be in the same position as the previous speaker. So there were no variables. You know, and they weren't interested in what you liked. They were only interested in whether you could consistently like something. You know,
whether you could identify a difference,
right? And which one, and then you could say which one you liked. And so they were using this horrible sounding CD sources. It was unbearable to me, and I ended up. Well, my response, I have it here. I could show you the bar graph. My response in the morning was really good. I mean, and my bar graph was pretty tall because I was able to do it pretty well. Some people whose names you'd recognize had tiny little shriveled little teeny little like.
Careful now. This is a family show.
They'd gone swimming. They'd gone swimming. But anyway, and I said to them, I said, I know that those two speakers. The numbers were those are Harman speakers. Those are the Infinity or the Revel, because the response was very flat and linear. But I wouldn't want to have, if that's the source material I would have to listen to, I couldn't listen to that. It was just hard on my ears. It was horrible. I said, the speaker I preferred to listen to was this speaker. And I'm not going to mention the brand, but I said, that speaker is the speaker that, even though I know it's got that coloration, the top end was not all bright and hard and flat response. So it was interesting.
It was very interesting. I totally agree. I got a couple questions in the chat room. Let me just post those to you. Coops asks, what do you think of the direct-to-disc vinyls from the late 70s?
Well, I'll tell you, direct-to-disc vinyl, it was unbelievably great. And, for example, there was a the LA-4 was a Concord direct-to-disc series that they did. And I've got a bunch
LA-4
of those.
LA-4 was a guitar quartet?
Yeah, it was her. I think it was Herb Ellis and Barney Kessel and Charlie Burr. I've got them out in the other room. But anyway, and then a Groove Note, a record label, got the tapes that were recorded at the same time and released them on double 45 RPM versions. And there's no comparison. The direct drive is just direct cut is just so much better. It's just. It was, in fact, someone just did a direct cut of the Vivaldi's The Four Seasons, and it's going to come out in a couple of weeks. A guy in the UK. I went to.
So he actually recorded the orchestra playing Four Seasons, and during the recording, he was cutting the master vinyl.
Yeah. The problem with doing that is that if you make a mistake, it's ruined. And so there's a nervous factor involved. People don't play their loosest and their best. But sometimes they do because they just say, I don't use as many lacquers as you need to. We get it right. I don't care. So
yeah, right.
Like I got this one at the Princeton Record Exchange. This is a Beethoven piano sonata box that Nimbus did. And it was done direct to disc. And it's unbelievably fantastic. The pressings are quiet and it's the most fantastic piano recording. So if you can get those, find them at garage sales or wherever. They're worth trying because they're amazing. As long as the pressing is not off center, because then you get wow and it's, you know.
I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. But first, the Gem Doctor is asking, what do you think of playing vinyl wet to reduce hiss and pop?
The only way I like a wet record is when I clean it. I don't want to. First of all, it's not good for the cartridge to play wet. And, you know, I'm going to post a file on my website of a record from 1969 that I've been playing since forever, of a very quiet guitar and finger cymbals, and it's dead quiet. It is dead quiet. If you clean records properly and play them back properly, you shouldn't have a lot of hiss and noise and pops and clicks. It's shouldn't be.
Well, that's... Sorry, go ahead.
The better your turntable, the quieter your records will play, even the records that have pops and clicks. People always say, well, you have an expensive turntable, don't you hear all the noise? No, it's the opposite, because what makes a turntable great is its ability to suppress impulse response that's not supposed to be there. So pops and clicks, instead of vibrating through the canyons of your turntable and finding their way up into the cartridge and then, you know, coming through your speakers, the better the turntable, the more it's able to suppress those impulse events. And it's one of the biggest surprises that people have when they say, all right, I'm going to invest in a really good turntable. They go, oh, my records are quieter. I wasn't expecting that.
Well, quieter, yes, but still there's a motor going and isn't there a rumble factor? I mean, I've heard people say, you know, there's 40 dB of rumble in any turntable. Is that not true?
I'm going by what I hear, and I don't hear rumble. I know John Atkinson says, well, you can hear the cutting lathe. I hear the cutting lathe when I, you know, my speakers go down below 20 hertz. I don't hear rumble. And sometimes you can see the speakers breathing a little bit because of the records aren't perfectly flat. But when I put this file up, it's a very quiet recording. It's a solo guitar and a finger cymbal and little congas. And
You sent me that, and I played it. You recorded that, you digitized that from vinyl to 24/192, so very high frequency sampling rate.
How'd that sound to you?
Oh, well, I don't have the equipment to, reproduce what might be there. It sounded beautiful from what I heard, which is basically just off my computer with a pair of B&W P5 headphones, which aren't bad.
Oh, it should sound pretty good.
Yeah, it sounded pretty darn good. I did hear, especially at the end, as the last note faded away and before you faded out the file, I did hear a little, it wasn't a popping or scratching exactly, but there was some what I would only call vinyl noise that I've heard very commonly.
There is some noise. There's a little bit of noise, but you better not go see any live music ever again. I go to the symphony, and let me tell you something. I sit there in Avery Fisher Hall, and most of the people there are very old. And I go in the winter, and during the winter, if you really want to concentrate on,
people are
dying of strokes. There's noise. There's people hocking. I'm listening to the music.
I go all the time to Disney Hall in L.A. and hear the L.A. Phil. And yeah, it's true. People are coughing and whatever. But on the other hand, there is a quality. And, we've been talking about ineffable qualities here during the show. And there is one for live music that I recognize. So I can't dismiss that there might be one for what you're talking about as well, because that's one of the reasons I don't really claim to be an audiophile, because I have never in my life spent tons of money on audio reproduction equipment, because I'm a professional musician as well. So I'm exposed so much to live music that no amount of reproduction can match that.
Well, of course. But I know a lot of musicians who have great stereos too, so mm-hmm. it's not a mutually exclusive thing.
No, I agree. I do agree. Eric
and it's
Duckman
pretty amazing. It's pretty.
Eric Duckman in the chat room is asking, how do we properly clean albums?
Okay. Well, again, it depends on how many records you have and how fanatically you would like to get. You definitely need to have something that wets the record to get the dirt off. And the Spin Clean for $79 works great. It really does work well. And it's a vat with a special chemical. You put the record in it and you turn it by hand a number of times, then you take it out, and then you put it in a dish drainer, and it dries, and it works really well. It's got a brush thing in it also. Mm-hmm. It's time consuming. And if you clean a record with that, you'll say, I have to clean all my records. I can't, even new records, because CDs are made in a clean room, mm-hmm. but records are pressed in a dirty room. So even new records have to be cleaned. But once you try that, that's the cheapest way to go. The next least expensive way is a manually turned vacuum machine. And there's one called the Record Doctor that's $299. That's very, very good. And then I think Nitty Gritty makes one. And the next up from that would be the VPI 16.5 or the Nitty Gritty, I forget the number, but those things turn automatically, and you put the fluid on and you brush it, and then it dries it. And once you hear that, there's no going back. And then if you really want to get really fanatical about it, you get an ultrasonic machine, which cleans records the same way you go to the jeweler and you bring your silverware, and it goes in a vat, and it, through cavitation, which is little bubbles that burst against the silverware, it gets all the dirt out of the nooks and crannies of the silverware. So the same thing can be done with records. And it's $4,000 for the machine, which is a lot of, but you'd be surprised how many people have bought them now. And you put the record in, you push a button, and it does it. And when it comes out of the air, I've had records that were noisy for as long as I've owned them and clean on every other kind of machine, and suddenly they're quiet. And you can get one for about $1,800. There's a guy that you can go on eBay and you can buy this cavitation vat and make something to like a rotisserie spit, and it'll work too. But there's a guy who's buys those and then makes it a thing that goes, you can do 8 records at a time, and it's about $1,800. So you get one of those, chip in with a bunch of friends, and you have it for a week, and then I have it for a week, and it's amazing what it does.
Wouldn't submerging a record, a vinyl record in a vat of liquid cause the label in the center to come off or wrinkle or?
Yes. it only goes down halfway.
Oh, I see. It only goes down and then you spin it around.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. What about the, I have to ask you about this device.
I got to tell you one story. I have a friend. I'm not going to mention names. I don't want to embarrass him. But he's really good with computers. And every time I'd have a question about computers, I'd call him and he would always be really nasty with me. He would always really get on my case and humiliate me and make me feel really bad. And then he got a really good turntable and it had an outboard motor with a motor switch on it. And he called me up and he goes, "You know what? This turntable, it's really good, but it's really stupid. Why do they put the motor switch on the back of the motor?" I said, "Because you have to turn the motor around and put it in front of you so the switch is in front of you." I mean, it doesn't get much stupider than that. And then he shut up about computers from then on.
Yeah, okay, very good, very good.
Okay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. But.
Yeah, that's quite all right. I had to ask you about, I think I saw a record cleaning system at Cedia maybe a couple of years ago called the Okie Nokie.
Yeah.
You know about that one?
Yeah, that's one of the vacuum operated machines, and it's a really noisy one. And I don't know why, you know, there are quieter ones that do the same thing. So,
right. Okay. Still in all, the question that I was sort of getting to a little while ago was about dynamic range. And vinyl, it seems to me, does not have a really wide dynamic range. Do you know what its maximum capability is?
Well, that's a very interesting subject. And I was sent a paper that I have most of it, but I can't find one page of it. It's really annoying to me. It was written by a guy named Ronald Bauman, who is an IEEE engineer. He's not like, he's not like a cook working in a restaurant. He's an actual IEEE engineer who made the argument with measurements that vinyl actually has a wider dynamic range than CD if you start the measurement below the noise floor where, you know, because vinyl, it's an infinite noise floor. It goes down to very low. And if you start measurement there, it actually is wider. Now, I don't know about that. I just know that when I listen to records most of the time, especially when CDs first came out, I would say, but the record sounds like it has wider dynamic range. Whatever the measurement is, the CD sounds compressed. And people say, well, it is, you know, they're using the cutting master or the blah, blah, blah master. They didn't have the right master. Whatever, the excuses just kept coming about why that sounded that way. There's just the certain, you know, I tell skeptics, I say, all right, come on over. Let's just sit down. We'll compare whatever, you know, the fifth or sixth mastering of the Clash or whatever you want to compare. And I'll put on my first pressing that I've had since 1960, whatever. And you tell me which sounds more dynamic, which has more musical give, which seems to, you know, and you tell me. And it never fails. Sometimes I'll play a new CD or a high-resolution digital audio download, and yeah, I can hear that it's got more. It definitely has wider dynamics, but dynamics are not everything. There's a whole bunch.
No, it's true.
You know, it's true. What it sounds like. You know, and I'm not doctor about this. I play a lot. I play plenty of high-res files, and a lot of them sound really, really good. And if 9624 files were the original CD, I probably wouldn't have been screaming the way I was screaming. And
when CD came out, you mean?
Yeah, and you know, and they were cutting these things. A lot of them were cut from bad tapes, and yet people were still saying they sound better than the records, and they did not. They did not. They sounded horrible, and the filtering, the original brick wall filters were terrible, and the original boards, were not digital boards, so they were taking these files, digital recordings, and then they were converting them to analog and then doing the EQ and processing and then putting them back to digital. So they're going analog, digital to analog, back to digital and then on a 1630 tape. And I mean, there were so many problems with it. And I didn't care how they did it. I just cared what it sounded like. And if it sounded worse, I didn't want it to be declared sounding better. That was, you know, what made me – no, I was crazy before that. I'm sorry. But that crazier. That enhanced my craziness. And I remember when I will not mention this mastering engineer, but I met a very well-known mastering engineer who had just finished doing the Peter Gabriel catalog, the first CD go around from the master tapes, and he was very proud of it. And I had met him not because of audio. I had met him because a friend of his had an old Saab that he couldn't get the clutch disengaged, and it was in his driveway, and I had met this guy with the Saab. years earlier down in Soho, and somehow he saw my car and came out to talk to me, and we exchanged cards, and he called me up and said, my Saab is stuck in this guy's garage and I can't get it out. Could you help me? I said, I know exactly how to solve that problem. So I drove down to his house. And they came outside, and the guy said, hi, I'm so-and-so. I said, oh, I know you. You're a mastering engineer. He goes, you know what that is? I go, yeah, I write for the Absolute Sound. And I said, I can fix your car. So I got his car fixed. And then we talked, and he says, I just did the Peter Gabriel catalog. You want to hear it? I said, yeah, bring him over. So he came over to my house, and he put on the CDs. And I said, let me play you an original Charisma pressing of that. And I put on the record, and he turned red. And it was like, oops. Oh, my God.
He heard it too.
He heard it because his system at that point was not really up to the job. Now it is. Mm. That's one of the great things about what's happened over the past 10 years. Mastering engineers have gotten much better systems past 10 or 15 years, and they know cables make it. They know all these things make a difference, and they're rewiring their systems, and they're listening, and they know that they can get in trouble if they get too doctrinaire about any of this stuff. Mm. It's a really great thing.
I will say that last month I met, I went to this high-res audio thing at CE Week in New York and met Bob Ludwig, a very well-known mastering engineer.
Yeah.
And I asked him about, you know, is there information on these old analog tapes that translates, that 2496 captures, that which CD quality 44.116 does not? He said, yes, there can be. It depends on how the tape was stored, how the tape machine was aligned, the console. He said, but the more important factor about why these high-res audio recordings re-releases sound better is because they were remastered with more experienced ears and better equipment and so on and so forth. So that, I thought, was a pretty important thing to say.
Yeah, absolutely. However, I will say this to you. If you have an original pressing in good shape that was cut properly when the tape was brand new, you've got a leg up on any reissue that's sourced from a 45-year-old tape. I mean, that's just...
Okay. You know. So, if you know, like as in the Abbey Road story that you told at the beginning, which is they were using the original pressings of the vinyl as the reference for what the final outcome of what they were doing was supposed to sound like.
Yeah, because sometimes when the tape gets put up, the top end maybe a little bit's gotten lost over 40 years or 45 years. So maybe they got to goose that up a tiny little bit to just recapture that. On the other hand, some tapes like the Blue Notes, those tapes are unbelievable. The, you know, a lot of it's Scotch 111, and those tapes seem to have lost nothing. I've heard some of those. They're amazing. And the vinyl reissues that Music Matters and Acoustic Sounds, Analog Productions have put out are amazingly great. I know some of the purists like the originals better, but a lot of these to me sound better than the originals because they don't have to compress them. They cut it wide open. They don't do any compression.
Well, that's certainly one thing about modern music, at least popular music, that is a great problem, is that it's compressed to within an inch of its life dynamically. You know, it's within 2 or 3 dB because it needs to play on the radio or whatever, makes it sound louder. It's this whole loudness wars thing, which I know Mark Waldrop is fighting against. He's fighting the good fight to try and get people to record with greater dynamic range, which again requires you to sit and listen. It's not for out while you're jogging or driving in the car when there's all this road noise.
Right. And you can always, you can do that compression yourself if you want, after you get the music.
Exactly.
And, Harman just published a short video that you can find online. I put it on my Facebook page about this whole subject of high resolution audio and dynamic compression and all these issues. And it's pretty good.
Oh yeah. I'll definitely go check that out.
The industry is making an attempt to correct what they should have been fighting from the beginning. I mean, this should have been fought from the beginning, and it wasn't, which is too bad.
Yeah.
But we're going to get back to good sound because people want better everything in their lives. People want better food. They want better clothing. They want better cars. They want better sex. They want better experiences. They want better, except for one thing, sound. They insist on crap. And it's ridiculous. And why, you know, when you go online and look at these stories where people try to espouse for better sound, all the comments are these snarky, nasty comments. Oh, yeah, sure. And you're telling me that a $200 speaker is going to sound better? Come on, that's ridiculous. It's good enough. MP3 is good enough, and it doesn't get any better on your audio files. It's like, what is that? It's the only subject. If you say to somebody, you know, if you go to the fish market and buy a fresh piece of fish, it's going to taste better than the, you know, Gorton's fish sticks. No one says otherwise. But when it comes to audio, there's this resistance. There are all these people, and they're angry and they're nasty and they say really stupid things. But that's because the audio industry and the record industry and audiophiles don't fight back. I fight back.
Well, and they do on AVS. I'll tell you that for sure.
they just fight. I mean, I get into some of those fights.
Yeah. But certainly on some of the threads related to my high-resolution audio test and a question I posed some months ago now, asking whether or not high-res audio is irrelevant or not.
Yeah.
I didn't take a position on that. I wanted to hear what the members had to say. But man, oh man, they get into some...
did a lot of them say CDs are perfect, the holy grail and
well, not the holy grail, but they said you know, it's perfectly fine. CDs are perfectly fine. You can't get any better than that.
Since when in the world, it's like, does anybody argue that NTSC television, it can't get any better than that? Oh, high definition television, you can't see the difference. Now, some people could argue that 4K versus HD, you can't see a difference. But
Depends on how close you are to the screen.
Yeah. But you can see it. I think you can see it.
Yeah. But it also depends, for me, it depends on what information is there or not. Which gets back to the provenance of the recording. What information was on the tape? What information was on the vinyl when it was digitized into 2496 or 192? If there wasn't any information there beyond what CD can capture, that's really the question.
Yeah. I agree. Look, I was in a Sony event. This is years ago when they had a recording studio. I went back in the day, and it was a DSD demo, and they had a live jazz ensemble playing, and first you could hear them playing live in the studio. Then you'd go into this room, and they had a pair of Wilson Watt puppies, whatever iteration it was at that point in time.
Really nice speakers.
Then they let you hear. You could hear a 16-bit 44K. In fact, they had a switch there. You could switch back and forth between the 16-bit, the 20-bit super bit mapping version, and then I think it was 9624, and then DSD. And the DSD was on a breadboard at that point in time. They didn't even have, you know, a chip. It was just on a breadboard. And as you went from the live mic feed to 16-bit, the whole thing collapsed. And as you got back up to DSD, it opened up again. It was really easy to hear. It wasn't subtle. However,
presumably the microphones and the signal path, though, were able to carry information beyond what CD represents.
Yeah, but there were people there from some of the mainstream audio magazines. I'm not going to mention any names. But I'm so tempted. But
No. Don't worry about it.
They insisted that they heard there was no difference. I said, you don't hear that? You don't hear this space? No, because they were invested in CDs being perfect. And you could say I was invested in them not being perfect. Fine, whatever you think. I still think most people sitting, listening, watching this, if they were in that room and they switched it, they would hear it. I don't think it was even close.
Not subtle. Well, on that note...
Like me, not subtle.
Not subtle. On that note, I'm afraid we have to come to an end. It's been a fascinating hour of discussion, and I want to thank you so much for being here.
It was my great pleasure again, Scott. You're a great host, and we're the orders.
Thank you. I'll ship them right out.
Okay.
You can of course read Michael's work which is voluminous. On analogplanet.com.
And you can listen to some of it, too.
You've got files.
You can listen to phono preamps and compare phono preamps. We have comparisons where you can listen to stuff.
Hey,
cartridge
that's
comparisons.
Incredible. So if you have any interest at all in this analog domain, Michael's your man. You really want to really want to go to Analog Planet and check that out.
Thank you. It's fun, too. It's fun.
And it's a fun place. I go there. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. And you can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. And you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/htg or on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Peter Chaikin, a senior manager of recording and broadcast for JBL Professional. And he will be on, I think, with one of the engineers who designed the new M2 speakers, which are really taking the professional audio world by storm. And I think have something to say about the consumer audio world as well. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.